It's a pleasure to be here down under, and in these times it's a pleasure to be anywhere. I come to share an experience, my experience, which should be a source of encouragement to all of you, because I have been 45 years actively involved in the cause of life, actively, and it only took me 22 years to learn how to do it right. So you're probably, I'm still probably, you're way ahead of me. You're way ahead of me, hey? You know, we know a lot more about life today than we did in the Middle Ages. I don't know if you know, this is a true story. You know, an Irishman saying, this is true. Now listen to this. Why do you have to say this is true? Because it is true. There was in the Middle Ages, there was a village, and there was a family in this village that was very, very polite. Right? And they had a daughter that was incredibly polite because mom and dad were very polite. Right? And as a young girl was growing, they were hoping she'd meet a very polite young man.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, and lo and behold, it was in the same village, another very polite family, right? And they had a young fellow. And the people in the village said, wouldn't it be wonderful if this young woman, who's so very polite, and this young fella fell in love and they got married? Wouldn't that be beautiful? Well, it did happen. It did happen. The very polite young man fell in love with the polite young woman and they got married and the whole town rejoiced. And then they were waiting to see if there would be a child. And nothing happened. And about a year or two later, the word went forth, she's pregnant. And the whole village rejoiced. In fact, they all stopped working and they were all waiting for the birth of the child. It was different then, you see. But so what happened was 9 months passed and she didn't give birth. So 10 months passed, she didn't give birth. 12 months, didn't give birth. 2 years, she didn't give birth. Because people started to say, we got to get back to work. What are we doing? You see? We got to get back to work. So it happened that she never gave birth. She never gave birth. It was a very great mystery. And the couple grew old and the man died, and finally she died. And some of the older people in that town, they were absolutely confused. What was the story about this? And when she died, they said, we should have an autopsy and find out really what happened. And so they did. And they did an autopsy, and they opened up the womb of this old woman. And do you know, this very polite young woman married a very polite young fellow. Do you know what they found in her womb? They found in her womb, this is true now, this is true, they found in her womb two old men with long white beards, each saying to the other, after you, after you. You. Yeah, you're too polite these days, you'll never even be born. But, you know, a number of years ago, I did a vigil in Bratislava. It's a city in Slovakia. It was sort of towards the evening time. And as we were going to the square, I noticed a lot of young people kneeling in the square. And later I spoke to the helpers and I said, what were all those young people doing in the square kneeling there? And they said, well, Father, they said, that's because there was no more room in the church. No more room in the church. Huh? I thought to myself, isn't that incredible? Incredible. Yeah? No more room in the church. And what's happening in the Eastern Bloc countries at the present time is incredibly positive for life, for life. Dr. Imre Tiglasi is a man who 15 years ago started to help us in Hungary. And what they would do in Hungary, when we go to a place in in Eastern Bloc countries, for the most part, abortions were done in hospitals, didn't have freestanding clinics. And so Dr. Imre Tiglathi in Hungary, it was 1,000 years history there. King Stephen was the king of Hungary, and they're very concerned with dates, historical occasions. So he would always pick out an historical date for us to do the vigil. And then at the end of the vigil, he would enroll a proclamation, and he'd call out the administrators of the hospital, and he would say, on this day, because of these things in the history of Hungary, will you be willing to pledge and sign this agreement in your hospital on this day? There'll never be an abortion again in this hospital. And they would sign the documents, sign the document. And next vigil, we go to another hospital, find another date. You see, roll out the scroll, they sign the thing, and would you be willing in this hospital and that hospital on these days? Eventually start going all through, we start going through the calendar. See, going through the calendar with proclamations. Well, you know, just recently, starting January 1st in Hungary, they have a new constitution in Hungary. And one of the persons who had an influence in that, the new elements in that constitution was Dr. Imre Tiglathi. And what they put into the constitution for Hungary starting as January 1st is life in Hungary will be protected from the moment of conception until natural death. And in that same constitution for Hungary, it said only a marriage between a man and a woman will be recognized in law in Hungary. In Poland, the parliament recently voted overwhelmingly no more abortions in Poland. In Russia, you can't get an abortion after 12 weeks unless your husband's going to jail. And the president of Russia recently signed a law saying anyone who advertises abortion in Russia must include in their advertisement clearly to be seen by the woman that abortion is a dangerous medical procedure. As a matter of fact, as I was telling Paul, when I was coming here, I got a phone call from Russia. They're having a big conference for life and they want me to go to Russia. And I said, no, I'm stuck with down under. You know, there was a Jesuit called Father Walter Chizek. And Father Walter Chizek, he wrote a book with God in Russia, He Leadeth Me. And he went to Russia many years ago to bring the faith, but he was arrested as a Vatican spy. And he was put into the gulags. And he was there for, oh, God knows, 25, 30 years. And one of the things that he told me was, he went in before Vatican II. So the prisoners, the Catholics in the gulags, they thought that the Eucharistic fast was still. You couldn't have a drop of water from midnight the night before if you're going to receive the Eucharist the next day. And the only thing that they would receive for the whole day was some gruel in the morning, and then that was it. So when they would find that somebody got into the camp some bread and wine, the people would just not eat for 48 hours. And then on the lunch hour, which was not a lunch hour, it was a break because there was no food except the gruel in the morning. They would, from a trunk of a tree, they'd put the bread and the wine. And Father Chizek, from memory, he would recite the Eucharistic prayer at the risk of his life. And the people, one by one, would come over and they would receive the Eucharist at the risk of their life. And he said, he told me there was no greater masses he offered in his priesthood than those in the gulag at the risk of his life. And finally, he didn't die. He lived. And he survived. And he started to serve the people in Russia. And he told me at a Easter vigil, he started giving out the Eucharist 9 o'clock in the evening. And by 9 o'clock the next morning, they were still coming to receive the Eucharist. He felt so fulfilled that finally he was doing what God wanted him, to bring God to Russia. And suddenly he was picked up by the KGB. In America, there were two Russian spies caught in an area called Englewood, New Jersey. And they had already told the Jesuits that Father Chisholm was dead. As a matter of fact, they buried him in the cemetery up in Orrysville. I visited his tombstone. Okay, I saw it. And then suddenly, the Russian government announced that he's alive. He's alive. And they want to make an exchange through the American State Department, the Russian State Department, and the Vatican of the two Russian spies for Father Chizek. And Father Chizek had no idea what was going on. And suddenly, he just got picked up, put on a plane, and was back in America, totally brokenhearted, because he wanted to bring God to Russia, and he finally was doing so. In Russia, as you know, all the churches were closed, barred closed. But by God, you know, the people resisted. People actually went to prison, to the gulags. Some died. But everybody was waiting for the time that the church doors would be open and they could praise and worship God again. And that's what's happening as I go through Eastern Europe. The people with joy are repairing and restoring their churches and praising God. When Father Chizek came back, he came back to New York, and he looked and he said, "My God, the doors of the church were never locked. How blessed you are. How blessed you are." And then he went inside to the church, and he found no one. Nobody. He said, "Where have the people gone? Who did this to you? Our doors were closed and barred." He said, "But you, your doors are open. Who did this to you? An enemy has done this to you. You are atheist. And you don't even know it. You have made your society godless. And no resistance? No one going to prison? No sir. How? Who did this?" It's a very interesting question. Who did this? And how it happened, you know, it's important to understand that. We did it by choice. We were told, you know, you shouldn't allow your opinions to be forced upon someone else. And little by little, juridical act after juridical act, the values that were in the law were being replaced. They were being taken out. So that some person, we had in America, Madeleine Hare, she was an atheist and she didn't want her daughter to listen to anything about prayer or God in the schools. So we removed God from all the school system by one person. Then one person. And suddenly we took the Ten Commandments of God, and little by little, as Father mentioned, the bishop mentioned earlier, you know, you hand on to your children before you die the best inheritance you give them. It's not money. It's not money. What you give to your children, and the most important inheritance, you give them the gift of life. And if they are blessed, you teach them how to live. And you love them. And if a person could say, "I received life from my parents, they taught me how to live, and I was loved," the rest is meaningless. The rest is meaningless. There's many of which person hands on their riches to the children who have never really been embraced or taught how to live or been loved, and they are incredibly poor. But what the important thing is that for a culture, you hand on values in your home, and one generation, we don't have to start all over again to figure out how to live in a civil way. Our ancestors, those who've gone before us, they give us the gift of law. And in the law, they contain the moros, the mores, by which we have learned this is how to maintain a civilized society. And our laws contain the values of Christian Judaic values. And we handed that on from one generation to the next. And that's what made us great. Our founding fathers, the Declaration of Independence in America, when they said that certain truths are self-evident. You don't argue about them. Number one, the most self-evident truth is this: life comes from God. Not from the state, not from person, no one. Life comes from God. And any state that does not respect life has lost its validity. We do not have to obey you. We declare our independence. And suddenly, you know, that's being turned upside down. It's being changed. And all the values by which we receive from our ancestors, how to live and how to have a civilized society, which was contained in the gift of law, the gift of law. See? It's what made us great. Western civilization was based on the fact that everyone's life was sacred, everyone's life was precious. And suddenly, these values, one by one, decision by decision, the Ten Commandments of God started to be removed from our laws. You know, we take, say, you know, when you have this culture of death, and you have to remove, like, thou shalt not kill, honor thy father and thy mother, keep holy the Lord's day, everything has to go. You realize that, and everything has gone without a whimper, with no resistance, in the name of choice, in the name of choice. And so what we have is, we've changed the fifth commandment of God. And we did that, see, a lot of people know, recently we just celebrated a memorial of the 39th anniversary of Roe v. Wade. Roe v. Wade in America was the Supreme Court decision that allowed the unborn children to die. Well, that's what most people think. Roe v. Wade was the decision that ended Western civilization. That's the truth. Right? That's the truth. You know, we did a prayer vigil and on January 22nd in Phoenix, Arizona, before I came here. The Phoenix crowd is, well, they're just like the Melbourne crowd, I'll tell you that. You see, they are relentless. I've gone, the last four times I went to Phoenix and did a prayer vigil, the clinic closed. So this time, they wanted to keep my record going, but to really test me, they were looking for a grand slam. So in 3 days, we had five prayer vigils at five different clinics before I came here. I think they're going to break my record. That's what I think they're going to do. But at any rate, what happened with the First Amendment was it was not the end of the protection of the unborn children. In that Supreme Court decision, everything was turned upside down. See, there was a philosophical battle that took place. The philosophical battle was this. Before Roe v. Wade, we believed that the right to life was absolute, no exceptions. And people's quality of life, it differed. But no matter what the quality of your life, you had the right to life and must be protected. And suddenly, with the Roe v. Wade decision, we changed that. And we said, the quality of life is the absolute. And your right to life depends upon the quality of your life as determined by others. Determined by others. So for example, instead of a decision by a court that's trying to say, is this law in conformity with the Constitution or not, we have an activist court that said, what do you want? We'll find some words or phrase in the Constitution to give you whatever you want. It's an activist judges. And what they did was, they said, well, you want to change things upside down, we'll do it. And the way we'll do it is, they began in the very opening words of Roe v. Wade, they said, since the unborn child, the unborn life, is not yet capable of meaningful existence, therefore, the state will not protect them. Now, it's very interesting how we buy into this. As though citizenship or birth makes you into a person or a human being. Because the child is not yet born and is a citizen, therefore you can do whatever you want with it. Wait a second. Citizenship and personhood and humanity and personhood has absolutely nothing to do with birth and citizenship. You see, you always precede social engineering by verbal engineering. You determine, once you determine the terms of the debate, and you let me determine that, you're dead in the water. See? And we just buy into their terminology. See, we buy into their terminology. And so in this debate here, what they do is they are saying that the child, because it is not yet born, is not yet a citizen, it's not a human being. It's not a person. Well, my friend, how about the people who are visiting America from Australia last year? They weren't citizens, and they didn't have citizenship. Could you kill them? Why not? They're not, they weren't born here, they're not citizens. What has citizenship have to anything to do with a person? How about illegal aliens? Can you kill them? Yeah. What has it? What is this nonsense? Because the child is still in the dependent stage that you can kill them. I mean, we send astronauts to the moon and they're inside the little capsule. If you take them out of it, they're dead. So we can kill them. The same thinking. And we accept this nonsense. The nonsense is not whether they're a citizen or not, whether they're born or not. The question is it a human being? Is it a person? And if it is, you may not touch that person. You may not hurt that person, see? So what they did was they changed in the decision the terminology, and they said that since the unborn child, it's interesting, is not yet capable of standing on its own, is not yet capable of meaningful existence, we will not protect it. And so they divided the term of gestation into three trimesters. In the first trimester, no reason was needed to kill them. In the second trimester, just a little bit more. Third trimester, just a little bit more. And not until you were born would we protect you. What are you talking about? And so suddenly, we turned everything upside down, and we said that the quality of life is the absolute value, and your right to life depends upon the quality of your life as determined not by you, but by others. For the moment, it looked like it was the unborn children. But eventually, you widen that circle and includes you and me. Because as the quality of your life goes downhill, it's the door to euthanasia. Right? The same thing. You are no longer treated as a person. You're in the vegetative state. My friends, you're never a vegetable. Don't tell about your mother or father's in the vegetative state. Never lose that language, okay? You are human from the first moment of your existence until you die. You are genetically, modern molecular biology shows that genetically from the first moment of your existence, you have to be genetically human or you never will be. You don't evolve from a fish to an animal and so forth. This is nonsense, okay? That's archaic thinking. In other words, you are human from the first moment of your existence, or you never will be human. And so what happened was, they opened the door, and they changed the fifth commandment of God to say, thou shalt not kill an innocent human being unless the quality of their life is not acceptable to you. Then you can do what you want with them. So it's a Down syndrome child. In America, as you know, 90 out of every 100 Down syndrome children are now killed. In Europe, 95 out of 100 are now killed. Right? And once you start going down that route of thou shalt not, so we changed the fifth commandment to God, did we not? And we had people accepting because we brainwashed them into believing life is not worth living if it's with pain. Life is not worth living if you're imperfect. Life is not worth living if it's not the quality of life you deserve. And therefore, mercifully, we are going to put you out of pain, take away your meaningless life, and we're going to kill you. And we start to accept that you shall not kill except in the case of the quality of the life of a person. Now, the second thing they had to do, of course, was to remove marriage. Remove marriage. And we sort of helped that along when we rejected the teachings of the church by Paul VI. See, Paul VI, you know there's three documents by the church with the word vitae of life in the documents that are very important. Humani vitae, the gift of human life, donum vitae, the gift of life, and evangelium vitae, the gospel of life. You say, well, Father, why are there three documents? Why is it just one? Right? Why do you need three? Because the church is a living, vibrant society, living in time, and things change, and the church has to keep addressing and speaking to what is happening at that time. And so Paul VI in the 60s was challenged with the concept of family, and the family being the place where human life should be conceived. And so he had to defend family and the process of procreation. And he said, what God has joined together, no man must put asunder. What has God joined together? He said, well, God calls a man and a woman to cooperate with God in bringing a human being into existence who is to be forever. And the man and the woman, he wants them to be bound together in love. so they're husband and wife. And so that they're able to bind the wife, he said, God, wisely, it's impossible for a woman through practically the whole of her cycle to conceive a child. So the father, the wife and the husband, can the unitive aspect of love, it can be cemented and grow and increase. And God wants, in the context of a loving act, a human to come into existence. And so it says, but there is a time where God is calling mom and dad to cooperate with God to bring a human being into existence. And we don't reproduce a human being. Reproductive rights, don't use that term. You're using their terminology, they got you. You can't reproduce a human being. You reproduce animals. When you came into existence, the whole world was altered. It required a special act of creation on the part of God. See? And when God made you, you'll never be the same again, and you're forever and ever. You see? So there's an aspect of God. When God made the world from nothing, we call it creation. And when he made a human being, we call it procreation. Speaking about creation, I was trying to get into a hungry Budapest, and this person's on the phone, and she said, I said, Monsignor. And she said, oh, Bishop. I said, no, I'm a Monsignor. Now, in Europe, you see, a Monsignor is a term they use for a bishop. So I'm trying to explain to her that I'm somewhere in between, and get awful confused, you see. And it ended up that I started to tell her this, and I should have never said this. I said, do you know the difference between a priest and a Monsignor and a bishop? And she's listening. I said, a priest is ordained by the church. And I said, a bishop is consecrated by the church. And a Monsignor is a title created by the church. And everybody knows the definition of creation is to make something out of nothing. And she still didn't get it. But I was saying, well, I'm somewhere in the middle, like a vice bishop. I don't know what I am. But I said, but I got to Budapest hungry. It was in the evening. And it was St. Stephen's Cathedral. It was all lit up. It looked like a lot of people in there. I said, this can't be a pro-life mass. But it was full. And I walked into the sacristy. It's a true story. I walked into the sacristy, you see. And it's filled with priests. I said, my God, she got it wrong. She must have put down. She put down, I was a bishop of vice. A vice bishop. Everybody wanted to see the bishop of vice. So all these priests had come to see the bishop of vice, you know. And I'm in the sacristy, and I go to walk out. And they wouldn't let me out. They all go. So I thought it was a Hungarian greeting. So I went. So they repeated it, so did I. And then I realized, my God, they think I have a mitre. What am I going to do? I don't have a hat. The only hat with me was a Mets baseball cap. So and they weren't letting me out of the sanctuary. They weren't letting me out there. So I went over and got the cap, and I put it on my head very seriously, and I said, in America, very liberal, very liberal. True story. And then I walked down the sanctuary, and to my left I saw the cardinal was sitting there. I got that hat off fast. Oh, that's an interesting journey. But, anyway. But what happens is with the unborn, the value, we let them use the terminology, you see, and when they use the terminology, suddenly they are destroying our values because we're allowing them to do so. So with marriage itself, when we rejected humani vitae, we opened the door to rejection of marriage. We gave them, you see, in other words, if you're going to reproduce life in the laboratories, you have to do away with the fourth commandment of God. It has to go. But when Paul VI in the 60s was dealing with what was under attack was family as God made it, created it, and the process of procreation. And he said, what God has joined together, man does not put asunder. And then he has joined together that a husband and wife are called by God at a moment in that monthly cycle to allow God and life to take place. And then you see the beauty of sexuality. It's incredibly wonderful and holy, because what comes from the act of human sexuality is a human being who is forever and ever to praise God, to love you, right? And required an act of God creating with mom and dad. Magnificent, beautiful, right? But suddenly what we did was we made the purpose of sex, because of the whole contraceptive mentality, we made it pleasure. Pleasure. And to the point that if you were pregnant, to say, my God, what are you pregnant? Like you got cancer. My God, what are you going to do? Do you know what's happened? And we got to teach the young people. And suddenly we separated the act of human sexuality from its purpose, from the very to the life dimension. And we opened the door to what? You could never argue against homosexuality. How? On what basis? You don't like it? Tough. If your act is sterile, so is ours. But we love each other. So what's your problem? So technology, who allowed us to separate the act of human sexuality and love for life itself, it opened up the door to us not being able to say that there's a design, a purpose, a plan that we have to conform to and all people have to conform to. And so, but then technology went the next step. And the technology went the next step and said, well, as you we helped you to separate your act of love and sexuality from life. Now we're going to have life without human love and sexuality. It's called laboratory reproduction. So we have to get rid of family. So in 1974 in America, they decided one way of doing this, we can't just attack marriage, it's not going to fly. But we can encourage homosexuality. And it's no offspring. And eventually we'll say you're a bigot for not accepting equally a man, a woman living together. And eventually we break down that traditional marriage is no longer sacred, prominent, something created by God, but one of many possibilities. And then when we get that accepted, then we can get together and start really producing life in the laboratories. Really producing life in the laboratories. And that's what happened, of course. That's what happened. And I do know and understand this, that right now in the laboratories, the whole genetic, eugenic cleansing of the human race is taking place. Whether you know it or not, no child conceived in a petri dish in America, in Europe, in England, is allowed to be implanted in the womb of the mother if it fails the test. Did you know there was a test? People don't even know that. There is a pre-implantation test. It's a pre-implantation genetic diagnostic test. And if the children fails the test, that child is destroyed. Destroyed. Without asking permission. It is not. It's against the law to implant such a child. And so what happened? You see, when you're born in the context of family, well, thanks be to God, to continue to exist, you didn't have to pass a test. I didn't have to pass a test. I would have failed. But mom and dad accepts you, whatever you are. Down syndrome, intelligent, bright, what it may be. It doesn't make any difference. Everybody is embraced and loved for its own sake. Okay, but not in the laboratories. And so suddenly we have the situation where in the laboratories we're doing the cleansing of the human race, the genetically cleansing of the human race, in which we're screening out all the imperfect and we're correcting God's mistakes. We're creating this. So what we have done now is we've taken the fourth commandment to God, honor thy father and thy mother. That's shot. And in the laboratory, because there is no father, no mother, no God, no love, no one even cares about what's happening to the lives there, and they're being for experimentation and destroyed, and who cares? And the people in the laboratory are playing God. Screening, cleansing. And so what we now have is the fifth commandment is gone, the fourth commandment is gone, and of course already, if you want to pray, you go to your room and pray. Don't dare pray in public. So the first, second, and third commandment. And as you destroy the concept of what God has joined together and the total exchange, the sixth and ninth commandment to God. Do you understand? All the commandments of God are gone. They're gone. We are atheists without any resistance. We are living in a godless society. We're living in a society that imposes upon us values that are contrary to the Ten Commandments of God. So it's not simply overturning Roe v. Wade. And all of this took place over a long period of time. So when it happened in America, 1973, we thought, my goodness, this is the beginning of the culture of death. And it started the end, beginning of the destroying the culture of life. No, it was not. It was the reverse. All of this had been coming like a tsunami tidal wave from a long distance through the centuries with the thinkings of the eugenics, with the people Malthusian thinking of too many people, not enough resources, with the change of philosophy of Augustus Comte to positivism, and the only knowledge that you really can have is not by the faith, not by your reason, but the experiential knowledges. And all of these things were reaching their culmination. And so Roe v. Wade actually was a decision that resulted in the culmination of the culture of death and the end of the culture of life. And we did not realize it. We tried to go through the political system. And we found that already, instead of being made heroes, the media already was part of the culture of death. In the civil rights movement in America, if you were to be arrested, if you were to resist against discrimination, you were considered a hero. In the right for the life of the unborn, if you resisted, you were put in jail. You weren't even known. Even the Great March for Life in Washington that took place in D.C. a few days ago, that was blacked out across America, my friends.
Oh, no.
All the time. All the time. If you weren't there, you didn't even know it took place. But it did take place. It did take place. You see? That's the fact. And what's happened, of course, in America is that in the beginning, people were trying to go through the political system, including I. And I guess I went through every aspect, from withholding taxes, getting arrested, everything, okay? Yeah, I know. My mother, she's proud of me. But actually, I remember the first time I was arrested. Some of my fellow priests said to me, well, you'll never be a bishop. I said, I'll never be a bishop. They said, no, you were arrested, Phil. I said, oh my God. I said, when did they change the rules? I said, I thought it was a condition of being a bishop. I thought all the apostles to witness the truth were arrested and put in jail.
Exactly.
I thought my leader, Jesus, not only was arrested, they put him to death in witnessing the truth. When did they change the rules? I said, I thought they give you that scarlet cassock when you are made a bishop because that indicated you ought to shed your blood. Isn't that right? Maybe there should be an option. We have two cassocks, scarlet and yellow. Which one do you want? If you don't pick the scarlet, eliminate them. You haven't qualified to be a bishop. And it's coming on terms. We're going to have to stand up for the faith. We're going to have to make the commitment, you see. But at any rate, what we did was, we went through all these areas, and in spite of it all, because this culture of death was so overwhelming, it became clear no matter what we did, this tidal wave of death kept increasing. And so after 22 years, it was the Feast of Our Lady of the Rosary that God inspired me to start the Helpers of God's Precious Infants. See, the Feast of Lady Rosary, just a brief background, St. Pius V, he was implementing the reforms of the Council of Trent. And after the Council of Trent, the Council of Trent followed after the Protestant Reformation in Europe, and church was very, very weak. And the thing that held the Europe together was the church. And the church was no longer able to hold Europe together. It became weak. And the part of the ones that recognized the weakness was the Ottoman Empire. So the Ottoman Empire said, this is the time to take over Europe. It's weak. And they put together this armada of ships which were invincible. Before planes flew, the ones who ruled the sea ruled, okay? And so this incredible armada of ships came, and it was impossible to defeat them. It was going to go all the way over to the Muslim world, okay? And Pius V, he realized that he put together some fleet, but it was very weak, minor. But then he said, I'm going to say the rosary. And he asked Mother Mary to help me. And then he asked everybody, say the rosary. And suddenly, you know, the great battle of Lepanto, we should have lost without any problems at all. Okay? We won. And the Pope recognized it as that was the result of the intercession of the Mother of God. And so he created the Feast of Our Lady of Victory, which later became known as Our Lady of the Rosary. Okay? By the year 1989, I looked around the world and I said, my God, there's no free world that can come to the way to those who are enslaved. It's similar to the situation of Pius V. He had to go outside this world into eternity for his strength, for his help, in order to overcome this battle that was before them. And by 1989, the culture of death was spreading all over the world, all over the world. And so there was nowhere to turn. And so we decided to do as Pius V did. We'll go into eternity. We'll go into eternity to go to Mary, the Mother of God. And what we did, of course, was, you see, the culture of death, as you know, it started in the Garden of Eden. It started in the Garden of Eden, and it was there that it's demonic. It still is. It is demonic. And it was the devil that told humans in pride, you have no limitations. Don't let God tell you, you can't do whatever you want. Forget about God. And do what you want, and you don't even need God anymore. You'll be as bright as God. See? That sin continues right to the present day. See? And as a result, when they said, there are no limitations, we'll know as much as God, and they fools, they did it, and they lost everything for us. But then God said, you know, dust thou came from, and dust thou shalt return. But I will send someone that will take this dust and transform you once again into the image of God. And this one will come from a woman, and it'll be her son. And the woman and her son will conquer Satan and restore the culture of life once again. You cannot win this battle without the woman and her son. Get that into your little heads, okay? That's it. First book of Genesis, we see this is where it started and the promise was made. In the last book of the scriptures, the book of Revelation, we see the woman in the heavens with her son. Okay? And the war goes on because the offspring of the woman, the devil says, well, I can't get the son and the woman. I will go after the offsprings. I will go after the souls of those who are yet to be born and to live. That, my friend, is the real war. That is the real struggle between the kingdom of God and the kingdom that is not God. Whereas we used to think, well, it's saving the physical life of the babies. My friends, it's much deeper than that. It's saving souls. It's the battle for the salvation. Because when we go to an abortion mill to pray, we go there now as Jesus did. Jesus went, you know, when Jesus was going to Calvary, Peter said to him, Lord, that's a very dangerous place to go. Do you have that from people telling you that? This, you know, it's very confrontational. Yeah, confrontational. I mean, you could really get, you'd be arrested. What? Is he shed your blood? I mean, I know. It's called Calvary. And poor Peter said, you know, they're trying to kill you. And Jesus said to Peter, you know, Peter, you're very thick. You're almost as thick as Monsignor Riley becomes. It took him 22 years to get his strength, you see? But he said, don't you understand? I'm giving you, you have the Ten Commandments, Peter. I'm giving you one more. One more, and I'm going to show you how to live it. What's this one more? It's called loving your enemy, even unto death. I'm going there to die for the person who's going to put me to death. What? Yes, the only thing is going to convert him. Is the only thing going to, and he needs me. He needs my love. So it's interesting that when Jesus went to Golgotha, to Calvary, he went there not to save himself, but to give his life. And he went there out of love for the very people who are going to put him to death. You know, sometimes we think that artists depict Jesus as dying alone and abandoned at Calvary. And my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Psalm 22. But if you read Psalm 22 through, it's filled with hope. So with all. And Jesus did not die abandoned and alone, okay? As a matter of fact, he was surrounded by love, compassion, and prayer. John tells us his mother was there. And his mother, it's interesting. John says Mary was standing at the foot of the cross. She wasn't on the ground screaming, yelling. And she was a Jewish mother. And as a Jewish mother, I got to tell you this. She spoke to Jesus. She told her son a few things. No question. And I know what she said to him. She said, Jesus, let me tell you something. All these years, I prepared you, formed you, and brought you to this moment. Don't you dare now fail me. She said, I know you're a priest. And I know this is the sacrifice. This is your finest hours in the eyes of God your Father. This is the sacrifice. You are redeeming and going to bring the world back where dust will be transformed into the image of God. Jesus, you stay right on that cross. And I will stand here and pray with you to the very end. To the very end. Of course, Jesus, we do know, spoke to Mary. He said, Mary, you know, you're standing here and you're sinless. You're in the Immaculate Conception. There's no reason for you to do reparation for your sins. Do you know why you're here? Well, in the providence of God, the Father and I and the Holy Spirit, we intended you, Mary, to be not only my mother, but we intended you, Mary, to be the mother of the whole body of Christ, the Church. And my final gift to mankind is not the Eucharist. My final gift to mankind is my mother. And he said to John, behold your mother. And Mary, behold your son. It takes some people so long to find their spiritual mother in Christ, Mary, who loves you with this incredible love and is concerned that you and the unborn and all are formed in the image and fashion of Christ. It's incredibly important to know that. And you know, when the children die, it's important for them not to die alone and abandoned. And when helpers are out there, and you should be there, at Calvary, we priests had a bad record, you know. Only 1 out of 12 made it. We try to keep that record going, you see. But it is important that we be there, and you be there, see? It was always mostly women, wasn't it? Interesting. Still is. Yeah. Courageous. Wonderful. And so when you are there, and someday you will die. I don't know if we're going to get there ahead of you, see? I hope I get the right place. I'm saying, I can welcome you in. If it's the other, I won't welcome you. But anyway, when you get to heaven, and you get to the doors of the eternal gates, there's going to be some people there. The unborn. And you know, they're going to say, Jesus, you know, I had a very short time here on earth, just about that much, but these people recognize my existence. And Jesus, you know, not only did they recognize my existence, they suffered with me, they prayed for me, they loved me. These are my friends. Jesus, let them in. And he will. You see, that's the reality of it. So what is the important thing is that Jesus went to Calvary and he died for the people who were going to put him to death. We're told in Matthew, both thieves cursed Jesus. Did you know that? Both of them cursed Jesus. In Luke, we're told one of the thieves by the end, towards the end, began to listen to Jesus saying, Father, forgive them. He saw Mary and John. He's my God. He is a king. He is a king. Remember me when you enter the kingdom. And the centurion, we're told that it wasn't until Jesus died and put the lance in the side, then he believed and said, truly this was the Son of God. Was the Son of God. Many women in this culture are absolutely convinced by the demonic lie that abortion brings back yesterday, and they get on with their life again. And they're convincing themselves of this, and they want to believe it. And some maybe you can touch and reach beforehand, but most you will not. They are like the centurion, not the good thief. Some are like the good thief before they will reach and realize, my God, you're right, and take your help. But many of them, it is not until they're in the recovery room after the abortion. And their first reaction is, oh, thanks be to God, my womb is empty. My womb is empty. I get on my life again. And 20 minutes later, my God, the pain that enters their head and their heart, they say, my God, my womb is empty. and their self-esteem goes right through the floor, and they feel that neither man or God or anyone could love them again. And if you're there to save babies and not to save souls, you're long since gone. And if you're there to save babies, you're ready to curse and condemn that woman. But Jesus died for her. He loves her. Many women after, they come out and they speak to me and they say, Father, because I speak to them both before and after the abortions. I speak to them and they'll say to me, Father, could God ever love me again after what I've done? And I say to them very simply, Mom, it's the wrong question. Wrong question. God never stopped loving you. It's we who stop loving God. And God's question to you, Mom, is, will you love God again? And our job is to make present that unconditional, everlasting love of God to all these people caught in this culture of death, most especially for the women who have abortions. To reach out with the unconditional, everlasting love of God to the abortionist, to the people who work there, to the people who don't even understand that they are enslaved by this lie of the devil, of the culture of death. And when they finally experience Jesus, some people say, why don't you bring the Blessed Sacrament to Calvary? And I say, well, the reason is because they don't believe. They don't believe. And I said, do you know why they did believe? Because when Jesus came, he made visible. They could touch and taste this unbelievable love of God in Jesus. Father, forgive them, making up excuses for us. They don't know what they're doing. He gave his life for me. We who offer Mass, the Mass cannot stop at the ceremony's ends. We now have to be victims with Christ and bring this unconditional, everlasting love of God and make it visible. They can taste it and touch it and see it, and then they will believe. We need martyrs, modern day martyrs. Oh, you don't have to die. You have to be a witness to the unconditional, everlasting love of God. And when you do that, they will begin to believe. So the help is, what we try to do is we try to make present that unconditional, everlasting love of God, allowing Christ in his risen body to continue his work now through his mystical body. And we let Mother, Our Lady of Guadalupe, lead us to where Jesus wants to go today. It's still the same place. He wants to go to Calvary. He wants to go to the place where those are most in need of his mercy, where the babies are dying, people are in despair, and they're born to demonic lie, and they need Jesus. And so when we go to bring Jesus and the truth and the forgiveness of God. And when you do that, everything changes. And that's what the help is about. God bless you.
One thing, I'd like to know what you think, apart from prayer, which is the foundation, of course, but what do you think can be done about the problem of contraception?
Contraception, sure. You see, one of the difficulties with contraception at the present time is that most of them are abortifacient. And the Planned Parenthood went in recently in the United States to say, if you outlaw abortion, we're going to have to remove from the shelves 80% of the contraceptives. That's Planned Parenthood. I think we have to teach the teachings of the church. Most people who use contraceptives have never heard a teaching in their lives of why contraceptives is unacceptable, why it makes sense to conform to God's plan and design. And so I think education and, you know, God, this is crazy, but you know the silent no more thing that they have? People say, I'm not for that, okay? Sorry, it's okay. People do. I work with women to heal them and so forth, but I never would ask a woman publicly. She has to give a witness, unless she's so public everybody knows it. Okay, that's no business, eh? But I would take that sign off her neck, 17, 18-year-old girl, instead of putting it around her neck, I'd put it in front of every pulpit across in the world. And when the priest gets up, he'd have that sign around his pulpit. You see, silent no more. Please teach the teachings of the church. I think most people are going to get to heaven contracepting because they're in ignorance. But it's the watchman. You got to pray for us by God. You know, we may have a tough judgment. Okay. Next question.
Monsignor, you said you tried going through the political system for a long time. So could you just maybe expand a little bit there from what you went to after trying the political system?
Okay. Well, sure. In 1973, we tried to get an amendment to the Constitution. We tried to get so many laws, incremental type things. I withheld taxes in 1973, and we got the Hyde Amendment. We did almost everything, but it didn't make any difference because it didn't start with the 73 decision, this culture of death. This whole mentality of the Malthusian thinking, this, that there's not enough resources for the people, we've got to eliminate people, this eugenic thinking, Sir Francis Galton, you see, that we if we're going to get rid of people, we should get rid of it in an intelligent fashion, eliminate the imperfect, the poor, the retarded, and so forth. All these things were built into, and that was all in existence before this came, so we didn't realize that already we were so buried under. Okay? And so going through the system, it was sort of hitting your head against the wall. I have to tell you now, however, because in America, the first reaction of young people is to go immediately to the Achilles heel of the pro-abort industry, which is where the babies are dying and the mothers are being exploited. It's all across the country, you see. We have more than 100 bishops and 7 cardinals leading prayer vigils in America. See? And as a result of it, every poll in America now is overwhelmingly pro-life, young and old. So tomorrow does belong to us. And the politicians know that. Everyone running for the presidency in the Republican primaries right now, no one is for abortion. Everyone's falling over themselves who is more pro-life. That's the reality of it. But my point is that came from the streets with people praying and being at the place which is the Achilles heel, namely where babies are being exploited, mothers are being exploited, babies are dying, and when you weren't there, you're trying to go through the system, whether it be academia or in the halls of Congress or even the churches, you're not going to win.
Monsignor, you spoke a very good truth, like the bishop and like people of Planned Parenthood know how important language is. I'm interested to know what language do you use when you first see a woman approaching an abortion?
Okay. Language is important, and the question is, what is the language I first use when a woman's coming for an abortion? Okay. Well, the first thing is, you try to get their goodwill, docility, and attention. And when they're coming, I offer them a rosary bead. And I said, Mother, would you take these rosaries and pray for the mothers who are already inside? Because they need our prayers. Because no one's coming here unless they have problems and they're real. Will you pray for her? And I said, most of these mothers are about, they're single moms and they're about 10 weeks pregnant. And I have little Philip 10 weeks in my hand under my thumb. And I saw the little Philip, you see? And I said, this is what it looks like. I said, we do have help for them. Life centers, telephones, and I said, but it's very, very difficult to do this. It requires really heroic courage. They go from a moment of weakness, if they keep the child, heroic virtue. Okay? And I say to them, they need our prayers to do this. I said, would you pray for them and let them know there is this help? This is the help available for them. I said, if, of course, they do it, they'll have peace. On the other hand, I said, if they listen to the world inside in 4 minutes, and I pull out from underneath a picture of what happens to the child in an abortion, you see? And they see it. Now, and then I put it back in. Okay? And I say, look, even if the mothers have the abortions, I will be here after it because God still loves them. Okay? And I say to the person, which is true, because we're there to save souls, we said, even if mom has the abortion, when she comes back out, I will tell her about God never stopped loving her and try to get her back. Now, it's called indirect counseling. Indirect counseling, all the while I'm talking to her. You see? And then I turn around and say, Mom, could you use help? You see, did you ever have an abortion? God never stopped loving you. You got to then know that and come back and get started. And the whole thing takes place. See? So everything that the abortionists inside do not want her to know, they don't want to know what the child looks like, how they're going to get the child out. They don't want to know there's help available. They don't want her praying. They don't want to know about the mercy of God. She said past abortion, she can start life all anew. She learns all of that in 45 seconds on the way in. And then everything takes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Monsignor.
God bless you.
Listen to our prayer. Father, brought